Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case I have for you today is one about a beloved small-town doctor who died in a mysterious fire. Suspicion quickly fell on his caretaker's son. He's arrested, convicted, and later sent to prison. But years later, new evidence emerged, challenging everything the town thought they knew. This is the case of Doc Whitley. On March 15, 2005, at 10 a.m., a fire in the small town of Yeager, West Virginia, started to attract a large crowd. To me, it had to be a shock to everyone to see the house on fire because everyone in town had been to Doc Whitley's clinic as a patient or just knew him personally. Doc lived beside his clinic because he was the only medical doctor in town. Kathy Lively Hamilton said that everybody there was screaming and trying to get to Doc. She said the fire chief was trying to hold everyone back.
I know we should be worried about someone being stuck in a house fire, but why was the entire town worried about Doc?
Well, from what I've seen, Doc was confined to a hospital bed, and his bedroom was on the second floor of the house. After the firefighters went into Doc's house, they noticed that the couch in the living room was still on fire. As it was burning, they ran upstairs and found Doc's bed consumed by fire. During the chaos, they spotted a figure on the floor of his room. The body they saw was Doc's. They had to move his body a short distance to put out the fire.
So was Doc alive?
No, they actually knew that they didn't even need to attempt any resuscitation or other life-saving efforts. They knew that he had been killed by the fire. Doc's death stunned the entire town of Yeager. Kathy said, quote, "The fire chief told me Doc was dead, and I couldn't do anything. Part of my heart just broke," end quote. Kathy started working for Doc in 1979. She was a nurse and Doc's caregiver. She said he was always saving people's lives, and that moment, there was nobody that could do anything for him, not even me.
Alexis Whitley, Doc's granddaughter, said, quote, "There was quite a laugh in the community of Yeager. He was very well loved and respected because he was this penchant for connecting with people. His real name was Eb Whitley, but everyone knew him as Doc. He was the doctor. I called him Papa Doc, and he always said that I was just like him and I had his brain. I just felt so special that he loved me so much," end quote. Doc got a divorce when his son was in his early teens. Doc then remarried a woman named Sue, and they were together until his passing. Doc and Sue had two homes. There was their Yeager home that was connected to the clinic, and they also had their home on top of Coon Branch Mountain. It said when the clinic was closed after hours, if you need a doc, you just call him at the house. He'd say, oh, come on over, and it'd be 1 a.m., and that really fulfilled him. For 35 years, Doc Whitley and the Whitley Medical Clinic served the local community until a twist of fate changed everything.
In 2000, Doc had an accident that left him wheelchair-bound. Kathy said, quote, after Doc got injured, he relied more on me to take care of him, to work and help with things in the clinic. So I started doing the office manager, insurance clerk, nurse, janitor, just whatever I had to be, end quote. She said after the fire was put out and I seen them loading him up in the ambulance, I knew that would be the last time I would see Doc. Lead investigator David Taylor said, once the fire had been extinguished and the structure was deemed safe, law enforcement arrived on the scene. When the investigators entered the first floor and walked into the living room, they can see that the couch is damaged. There's soot everywhere, and when you look up, there's a massive hole in the ceiling.
So, how big was the hole?
About 6 feet by 8 foot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so if you look at the picture that's in the document, you can actually look through into the bedroom and you can see where Doc was found.
So the hole was near the bed.
Yeah.
Do they even know what caused the fire?
At first, no, but, you know, there's several possibilities. Doc was a heavy smoker and he was known to actually fall asleep or to drop a cigarette. So it's possible this could have just been accidental.
Oh my God, did I ever tell you all the stories about when my mom smoked? Like the time that she caught her fingernail on fire?
You did tell me that one, yeah.
And she thought she didn't blow out the match or whatever, and that flame was still growing. Like it melted like this funky design into her fingers. And then like she had burn holes all in like sweatshirts and stuff like that. Like, it's fantastic. Like, there would be big patches, like, cut out. I'd be like, well, she done burned something.
God, we're just out in the deb.
So, did Doc smoke in bed?
He did. Actually, multiple people told investigators that. The two assistant state fire marshals who were looking at the hole in the bedroom floor, or the burn pattern on the floor, the damage to the bed itself, said that it's nothing that happens with a lit cigarette. So they eliminated smoking in the bed as the cause of the fire.
Just from looking at the fire pattern.
Yeah, like how crazy is that?
It blows my mind. Like, gotta give it to firefighters because legit, how can you tell if something was arson, accidental? I mean, my luck, I would like burn down my kitchen and try to put something out and then something else would catch on fire. Like, it'd be a train wreck.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I just wonder how they can distinguish between accident, arson, that it was murder, somebody intentionally done it to get back at that person and stuff. It literally blows my mind.
Yeah.
How they're able to do that.
Same. Like, I don't know much about fire, so I had no idea there was a burn pattern, fire pattern, all of that. No idea. After they examined the couch and the location of the bed upstairs, they came to the conclusion that most likely in this case, there had been two points of origin. The investigators concluded that one fire was ignited in the upstairs bedroom, and the second fire, they believed, was ignited in the downstairs living room, most likely on the couch. And, I mean, with these two points in the house, it makes investigators believe that, you know, the fire was set intentional. The main theory was that the fire was arson. So after this, investigators searched for possible evidence of accelerants to start the fire. So they sent off fire debris samples to the state fire marshal's lab. The analysis from those debris samples took days to perform.
Why exactly does it take so long to be able to analyze all this?
It's a delicate process, I guess, because everything's kind of like soot and ash. It just might take longer to, you know, get everything squared away and just looked at. The day after the fire, an autopsy was performed to determine Doc's cause of death. It was learned that he died from smoke inhalation. Court, you want to read what the chief medical examiner said?
Quote, it is our opinion that Ebb K. Whitley Jr., a 70-year-old paraplegic male, died as a result of smoke inhalation and thermal burn injuries, affecting approximately 90% of total body surface, secondary to an intentionally set residential fire. Atherosclerotic coronary artery disease is a likely contributing factor to his demise. All the drugs found in the deceased's blood were present in therapeutic or subtherapeutic concentrations and included anticonvulsant medication, Valium, and other over-the-counter medications. No nalbuphine was detected in the decedent's blood. Manner of death, homicide, end quote.
One of the observations that was made inside the bedroom was a wheelchair that was close to Dr. Whitley's bed, which appeared to have been knocked over.
So if it wasn't for the wheelchair being knocked over, Doc could have lived.
I think so, yeah.
And do we know if it was just fire that killed him, or was he shot and stabbed as well?
Yeah, it was just fire. Like, I kind of wanted to see if there was more to the autopsy, but there wasn't. Like, what you said is that, you know, just fire. While investigators await the results of the debris test to determine whether this was arson, Doc's insurance company conducted its own investigation at the scene to verify the cause of the fire.
Did they notice anything different?
Well, you know the hole in the ceiling?
Yeah.
They noticed that the wiring was damaged.
Could they have ruled that out being the cause?
No, they actually thought that maybe the reason the couch caught on fire was from debris that is already on fire falling down from above and landing on it, setting it on fire. By the end of the investigation, the insurance review said that the cause of fire was undetermined. The lead investigator of the sheriff's department received information that a witness dropped off Jason Lively and Thomas Owens at Doc Whitley's house the morning of the fire.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
So before we go into that more, I did want to talk about the results from the fire marshal's lab. Which court, I have the results in the document if you want to tell everyone what they determined.
A miscellaneous ignitable liquid in the light range was identified in item number 12. Examples of this include single component products such as toluene.
Which, Court, I'm not sure if you know what toluene is, but I did Google it and I found out that it's mostly used in like gasoline, paint thinner, and nail polish.
So all the fun stuff.
Basically, like, it's what gives it the odor. The investigators with the sheriff's department began to look at who had been in and out of Doc's house.
So, Jason and Tommy.
Those are a few. One of the first pieces of information the investigators discovered was on the night before the fire, Doc was involved in a fight with his nurse, Kathy Lively. The president of the local bank was there and actually witnessed the argument. Like, Court, this argument was so bad that Kathy made the comment, "I will kill you."
Yeah, you don't ever say that.
No.
So did investigators ever talk to her?
They did. She said that they were throwing questions at me left and right. And I couldn't figure out all of this the way I was being treated. Now, one of the things I found out during my deep dive into this case is that Kathy had been operating the medical clinic as an LPN. and Doc was not involved in writing the prescriptions or getting prescriptions to patients, which, you know, was very unlawful.
Mm-hmm.
There was this theory that Kathy and her son Jason was using Doc's prescription pad, writing prescriptions for themselves and others, and Doc wanted to put a stop to that. So Doc made a decision to take everything away from Kathy. When the sheriff's department interviewed her, Kathy explained that he had fired her before and he took away the keys and everything from her.
Needless to say, they did not have the best relationship.
I guess you could say that. Kathy said Doc would fire me, I'd quit, but I never miss 1 minute of working with him. You gotta remember, Doc treated some of these patients for 40 to 50 years. So I would call their prescriptions in. I thought that was okay, that I was following Doc's orders about calling in their medications. So I went over to Doc's house and told him, and we argued because Doc wanted to be right and I wanted to be right. He told me to get the hell out of there. He's going to knock my brains out. And I said, yeah, and one of these days I'm going to kill you. She said it was like two old people were just bickering at each other.
Is it technically normal to say you're going to kill someone in an argument?
Yeah, no. But she said that saying that to Doc meant nothing. She said after investigators told her she killed Doc, that's when she left. She said, quote, if you're not going to charge me or something, I'm gone, end quote.
Did they keep looking into her as a possible suspect or what?
They did. They always kept her on their radar. They spoke with Doc's family and friends, too, to see, you know, if anyone else would have wanted to cause him harm. A few days after Doc's death, his widow Sue reported to police that she had a visit from Jason Lively at Doc's second home. After the fire on March 15th, Sue told investigators that Doc's laptop was missing, and Jason came up to Coon Branch and stole the laptop and left.
You have his mom, who got into this horrible argument with Doc. Then he goes into Doc's home and steals a laptop from a dead man.
Yeah, like, it's totally crazy. Like, why would you need to steal his laptop on the day of the fire? Jason, at the time, had a bad reputation from being a violent person, someone who abused controlled substances. The sheriff's department were able to contact witnesses who told them that Jason tried to sell the computer to them, but they told investigators they didn't buy it.
And why's that?
When they turned it on, they realized it was Doc's laptop, which during interviews, they were able to locate the laptop and get it back as evidence. So now they wanted to talk to Jason, which he did come in and talk to police. He said that Doc had given him the laptop, and all he was doing was going up there to take what Doc gave him.
Mm-hmm.
He explained his actions by saying that he was very upset about the fire and Doc's death, that he just wanted to make sure Sue was okay. He did say he had some previous run-ins with the law, but he denied having anything to do with Doc's death. In court, Jason actually had an alibi on the morning of the 12th.
What was it?
He said that he had been staying with a friend and he slept on the couch, and the person confirmed that he was there, that he did stay the night before.
So this was supposed to be legit?
Maybe, like, question mark? The problem was that the friend didn't know what time he had left his home in the morning.
So there's a good possibility Jason could have left his friend's home, went over to Doc's, and start the fire that morning?
Yeah. Kathy said that she didn't really care about the gossip and the rumors going around, because I know Jason. And Doc was more like a father figure to Jason. I knew Jason wouldn't do that. So it wasn't something I was worried about. 3 weeks later, a surprise witness came forward.
The lead investigator for the sheriff's department received information that a witness named Brian had been with Jason the morning of the fire. They were near a convenience store in Yeager, and Brian picked up Jason and Jason's friend Tommy, and they asked to be dropped off at Doc's house. Brian said he picked the two up around 7 a.m., then drove them to Doc's house.
Jason and Tommy were very close friends. They were the kind of friends that engaged in some criminal activities. They had been involved with setting a car on fire. So with this witness statement placing Jason and Tommy at the scene, Prosecutor Bale weighed in the evidence put before him.
He said, quote, "I was presented with all these circumstances. First of all, Doc made a decision to take everything away from Kathy. Then you follow that with the statement from Brian saying that he dropped off Jason and Tommy at Doc's house that morning prior to the fire. And then you have the statement from Sue that after the fire, Jason has stole Doc's laptop, which he then went out and tried to sell to get money for that. All of that together persuaded me to authorize warrants to charge both of these men, Jason Lively and Tommy Owens, with arson and felony murder," end quote. With arrest warrants issued, sheriff's deputies searched the area for Jason and Tommy.
Kathy said at 6 o'clock, "I turned on the local news and they were saying they arrested Tommy Owens for the murder of Doc Whitley. And then they said they arrested another suspect, Jason Lively."
How did she take that?
I mean, she said she was in shock. They denied bond. Jason went into the Southwestern Regional Jail in Logan, West Virginia. She said, "There's no doubt that I knew Jason didn't do it." Now, she did say something that just seemed off to me. She wasn't mad at Jason for doing this. She was like, "Not my child." She said she was more mad at Sid Bale for prosecuting Jason.
She says she wasn't mad at her son for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But she was mad at the prosecutor for prosecuting and doing his job.
Yeah, makes complete sense, right?
I guess.
So after this, they were getting ready for trial. And that's when a fellow inmate reported that Jason confessed. Jason allegedly told this inmate that he and Tommy went into Doc's house, allegedly to rob Doc, and they had set the house on fire in the living room as they left the house. So they scheduled a polygraph, which I just want to say, they're not that accurate and I really don't have that much faith in them.
Same.
So the polygraph actually wasn't for Jason, it was for the inmate that confessed, and it actually came back truthful. More than 18 months after Doc's death, the trial began. The prosecution led with testimony from the eyewitness Brian, whose previous statement tied Jason and Tommy to the scene. So they identified him in their opening statement to the jury and called him as a witness. But then they were caught off guard because Brian was testifying and he recanted everything.
Huh?
Yeah, he said that when he was questioned by the sheriff's department, he was threatened if he didn't do what they said and that they would take him back to Virginia.
Virginia.
He had a warrant for his arrest in Virginia. What he said under oath really shook up the prosecution's case. The defense attorney tried to discredit the witnesses based on what Brian said. They argued that the crime of the fire was undetermined, like the insurance company's investigators' conclusion. The fire could have been an accidental electrical fire. After that, they had the state fire marshal's office testify that the evidence shown the fire had been set, and they made every effort to corroborate what the witnesses were saying. Sid said that the importance of adding up additional circumstantial evidence, because at some point, you know, you hope the jury is going to say, well, they're not all making up these stories. They're not just lying about it. So after this, Jason's fate was to be decided by the jury. After 6 hours of deliberation, they reached a verdict. They found Jason Lively guilty of arson and guilty of felony murder. Kathy said, quote, "Jason and I talked about this the night before, if anything happened. Anything went wrong, and he was convicted for me not to cry." She said that she held it together for Jason, end quote.
During all of this, let me make sure I'm understanding this.
Okay.
Because I'm going to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here.
Mm-hmm.
You have investigators whose job this is.
Right.
To determine if it's an arson, where this fire was started, how it was started, all this stuff.
Right.
You have one who said that the fire was started at the bottom in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
And was the fire only contained in two rooms?
From what it looks like, yeah.
Okay, that's kind of odd.
Mm-hmm.
Because fires spread very quickly. We both know this.
And, yeah, and I don't have the picture in here, but from the crime scene picture, his TV in the living room was actually melted. Like, everything was melted. Like, it was, it's actually insane.
So, I'm a little confused on that. Number two, something I learned in a psychology class. There's no such thing as an eyewitness because your brain remembers what it wants to remember.
Yeah.
So, could he possibly just remember that he took him to Doc's house, that he dropped, Brian dropped off Jason and Tommy? And then after that, maybe he didn't remember no more of what happened by the time that this trial came around. And that's the reason why he wanted to recant.
Possibly.
And also, did they actually have enough evidence to be charged with murder in this?
No, not really.
Did they? And another thing is, too, like, maybe we'll get to this in a little bit, but were they just going to go over there, in all honesty, maybe as a revenge act for Doc firing Kathy, and what something was supposed to be like a little bit of a revenge went awfully wrong and Doc got murdered because of it? Because, I mean, either way, he got murdered.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've heard rumors from multiple people who are close to Jaeger that the rumor is that Kathy had something to do with it. And she just let her son take the blame for it. But, you know, after he was sentenced, she said that, you know, she hugged him and kissed him and told him that she loved him. And she told him that she would fight and would never give up for him.
Jason was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 15 years. 2 months later, Jason's alleged accomplice, Tommy Owens, faced the same charges, which Tommy was found not guilty for arson or murder. Sid said this caused him sleepless nights and that Jason had a right to an automatic appeal of his conviction to the State Supreme Court of Appeals, and he did appeal his convictions. With Prosecutor Bell questioning the conviction and Jason's appeal working its way through the system, Jason maintains his innocence from behind bars. The state affirmed his conviction and his sentence continued, which Bell said he had these lingering doubts about the case. He got Dr. Greg Baylor to look at the case and he gave me his expert opinion on the cause and origin of the fire and the evidence of arson and murder.
He explained that simply pouring a flammable liquid on a floor, it's going to burn up the liquid. There might be a little charring, but it's not going to burn a hole through the hardwood floor. He said it had to smolder for hours between the living room ceiling and the bedroom floor before it came out. The origin of the fire really pointed towards an electrical fire or an accidental fire in the subfloor.
So what we're saying right now is an electrical spark ignited the fire, which then could smolder, correct?
Yeah, you know, as it smoldered, the fire would have gone undetected. It would have been hours until the smoldering may have broke through, in which case the fire could have then really started to accelerate. And I want to say, you know, this kind of reminded me of the WU Medical Hospital.
Shelley.
It reminded me of Shelley because if you remembered, the fire smoldered for hours before, you know, boom, her entire house was engulfed in flames. So his opinion was that the experts were wrong, that it wasn't an arson fire, which means an innocent person was in prison. The evidence was submitted through the proper channels, but 2 more years passed while Jason remained in prison.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
Sid said that in 2014, he received a notice that there was going to be a habeas corpus hearing, which Jason's new attorneys were going to be putting on a case to try to show the court that he was entitled to a new trial. At the trial, Sid learned that Jason's attorney had not been in contact with Dr. Baylor. Instead, they put Sid himself as an expert witness. He was asked to interpret Dr. Baylor's report, and he said that he was unprepared as a witness and he didn't think he should have been one. At the end of the trial, the judge denied Jason's petition and his request for a new trial.
After this, Kathy didn't give up. She called the West Virginia Innocence Project. The first thing they did was go through the transcript from the habeas hearing. And when they saw Sid's testimony and that he misdescribed what the Baylor report said, they knew they wanted to talk to Sid Bell. In the document, Sid said, quote, "Because I was not prepared to testify about Dr. Baylor's findings at the time of my testimony, I did not accurately remember them during questioning. This, my testimony regarding Dr. Baylor's report and findings was inaccurate."
Which after this, Dr. Baylor and others did go to the house and collect samples, especially where it tested positive for toluene. Now, there's 2 state experts saying the fire couldn't be arson, and the prosecuting attorney saying that Jason is innocent. After being in prison for 14 years, the prosecutor finally agreed to a plea agreement to let him plead to a misdemeanor for petty larceny of the laptop and present it to a judge in Mercer County, who agreed to accept it and ordered Jason Lively to be released from prison. We will be out for a couple of weeks, but we will be back with one of West Virginia's coldest cases. We will be returning in a couple of weeks with one of West Virginia's most notorious cold cases. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find a good West Virginia true crime podcast.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, MountainStateMysteriesPodcast.com.